Chief Judge in the Judges of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States in this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Staff Sergeant Frankie L. Peterman II, ACM 38705. The appellant presents for our consideration during arguments today the following issue. During the government's case in chief, a member asked to see evidence of impeachment of the complaining witness that was referenced during defense counsel's cross-examination. The member was challenged for cause. Did the military judge err in granting the challenge for cause against the member on the basis of implied bias? Are both sides ready to present argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant's counsel, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 4 minutes, please.
4 minutes?
Yes, sir.
Very well. You may proceed.
Chief Judge Allred, Senior Judge Teller, Judge Zimmerman, may it please the court. I am Captain Lauren Shore, and along with Mr. Brian Miser, we represent Staff Sergeant Peterman. The member at issue, Captain J.G., asked a question that is common in courts-martial. He was seeking additional evidence. There is a standard bench book instruction to deal with members requesting evidence, but the military judge, rather than providing that instruction, decided to take the nuclear option and instead remove the member from the panel in the middle of trial. The members have this right to seek evidence and ask a question, and that is all Captain J.G. was looking for. Turning first to the standard of review. In the government's supplemental citation of authority, they pointed this court to United States v. Dockery, which was a case decided by this court just last month. And in that case, this court clearly stated that the standard for review on implied bias cases is less an abuse of discretion, but more than deferential, which is consistent with the case law from our superior court. And in that particular case, Dockery was a government challenge for cause on implied bias, which is identical to the case we have here. As we turn and look specifically at the implied bias standard and evaluating that under this less than deferential, but more than de novo review standard, we have to look at the questions on in an objective basis. We must recognize that these are questions of fact mixed with questions of law. Where the military judge is not consistent or in error in her findings in fact, she is given less deference or should be given less deference by this court in her conclusions. Now, turning next to the history of implied bias. Implied bias under RCM 912 is a substantial doubt as to legality, fairness, or impartiality. It's not just any doubt. And if you compare that to the military judge's ruling, where she states, he's got ideas in his head, and those are what he's following, not necessarily why what I'm saying. She says, he didn't know what he was thinking, which may be an inability to follow my instruction. She doesn't ever actually give us what the substantial doubt as to his legality, fairness, or impartiality is. She provides this court no basis for evaluating her decision. Rather, she simply pontificates and concludes, implied bias, so I'm going to remove him. There's no substance to her ultimate ruling. And in fact, when you compare it back to her findings on page 426 through 430, she frankly says, I don't think that he is interested in helping either side. She states that she hasn't given an instruction yet on how to seek evidence, and she believes that's what he was trying to do. When the senior trial counsel argues that he's leaning towards the defense because of the way he explained it's a question defense would ask, the military judge says that's not consistent with his explanation in individual voir dire. Specifically, he gives the explanation we would ask a member to give. He's concerned with getting the evidence. The defense was talking about inconsistent statements, yet did not offer any of that as evidence for the members. And the member was questioning, where is this coming from? Is this accurate? I want evidence. I want to seek the truth. Implied bias standard originated for use by the defense counsel because the convening authority is the one that puts the members on the panel. That's present in Castillo, Peters, and James, all cited in appellant's brief. Now, appellant is not here to say that the government is not entitled to the implied bias standard. That's not what the case law says. But the case law is specific that the implied bias standard should be used rarely. And the defense is the only one entitled to the liberal grant mandate. And so when you remove the liberal grant mandate from the analysis, you are stuck with a very rare opportunities to use implied bias for the government. When you look at cases cited by CAF, cited in the both parties' briefs, you can see that when government challenges under implied bias are granted, it is in extreme circumstances. In cases where the members are saying they have this inelastic predisposition, they simply cannot vote for the death penalty, cannot see themselves voting for it in any way, shape, or form. Those are extreme cases where government challenges for cause under implied bias are granted. And the facts of this case simply do not rise to that level. Finally, when talking about prejudice, the government has, in their brief, argued that prejudice is something that this court has to evaluate. And they've cited both record from the Army Court of Criminal Appeals and James, United States v. James from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. To the extent that any of the Courts of Criminal Appeals cases test for prejudice, they're erroneous. Four recent cases from CAF, along with one older case, that's Clay, Nash, Peters, Woods, and Dale, found that the military judge abused their discretion and they did not test for prejudice. The unique thing, if you look specifically at the Woods case, is CAF states that their conclusory sentence is the military judge abused his discretion and the error was to the substantial prejudice of a material right of the accused. Now, they do no analysis, though. They simply state that the judge abused his discretion and that was prejudice. Nowhere else where they find that the military judge abused discretion do you test for prejudice.
How should we factor into that those cases that talk about Batson-style challenges where there are three separate articulated ways of looking at prejudice?
Your Honor, I think that what you have when you're looking at it's hard because you do have the Batson-style issue, which is more unique to the race issue than what we have here. But when you're looking at prejudice overall, even if, let's remove that and say that we would evaluate prejudice in this particular case, I think what you're stuck with is there's no way.
Let me touch on that specific issue. Is there something distinct from this type of grant for implied bias that separates it from the Batson issue that would lead us to not test for prejudice at all versus one of the three? And you can argue out which one of those ought to apply if one should. But how do you make that initial branch of testing versus not testing?
Yes, Your Honor. In looking at the Batson, and I guess what I would step back and say, I think that the difference ultimately comes down to the Batson issue in dealing with peremptory challenges and things along those lines. The case law from CAF that talks about those was prior to the change in the peremptory challenge scheme. And so I think that now under this new scheme, this different scheme that we have, you have to look at the more recent cases in CAF's decision-making and see that they don't test for prejudice. And I think that's why it takes us out of the realm of the peremptory challenge Batson-type cases.
Do you think it's structural error or just something different that doesn't require a test for prejudice?
Something different that doesn't require for prejudice, Your Honor. And frankly, it's interesting. The Woods case in particular is what sticks out in my mind because the court, CAF finds there was error, he abused his discretion, and that error was to the prejudice of the accused. And that's all they say. They don't do any test or any analysis. And when looking at that, the question becomes, how would any appellant ever demonstrate prejudice in these type of cases? You know, CAF doesn't require him, but how would we say this was prejudice because we don't know what this member would do? We have no idea whether this member would have been a strong voice in the deliberation room, and that points us to the government's argument about the numbers game. CAF has repeatedly said they don't subscribe to the myth of the numbers game, but even if we were to play that game, how would we know? We have no idea what this member would have done in the deliberation room or what the votes were.
So if it's not structural error, but it's something else, then that means that somebody has a burden with regard to prejudice. How do we know how to allocate that burden? Because CAF, the fact that CAF commented on the existence of prejudice suggests that it was worth weighing.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's, frankly, that's the difficult part about these cases. When looking at Clay, Nash, Peters, and Dale, none of them talk about prejudice, which is the strange thing that Woods all of a sudden branches out with this strange comment about prejudice. But none of the other cases do any test for prejudice at all. So it's hard to say whether there really is a test for prejudice or whether that comment was just there to for some other reason that it's hard to discern. It's Pelham's position that there is no test for prejudice, and when CAF looked at it, they said that the presence of a member or the removal of a member, when it's an error, is prejudice to the substantial rights of the accused, meaning he was not given a fair trial. Finally, Your Honors, the military judge's findings are internally inconsistent and in places in error and mischaracterize what occurred. I'd urge you to look specifically at the military judge's findings right after she had the discussion with Captain J.G. in the Article 39A session in his initial voir dire. When she makes those findings and later changes them without any explanation, that is where she is given less deference in her ultimate conclusion. She stated he is not biased. She was not concerned that he was helping either side. She did not believe he was burden shifting. She did not believe he had a misunderstanding of her instructions. He was clear that he was looking for additional evidence. And she concludes all of this and yet ultimately removes him. That is error. And her removal of Captain J.G. was an abuse of discretion, and the case should be reversed.
Yeah, I'm sure. Just a very basic level, doesn't the military judge have a duty to ensure that each panel member has proper judicial temperament?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And
taken as a whole, isn't there a pretty good argument that this member appeared to be something of a loose cannon? I mean, you've got that phrase from him, from Captain J.G. No one wants to deal with that. He said, she said crap. Then it appears that he's, at least from my perspective, you can rebut this and tell me how I'm wrong, but it appears to me that he's not merely humbly or receptively asking questions, but he seems to be trying to direct the proceedings in some fashion. He says, defense ought to be asking this. And when he asks, and particularly he's asking in a very sensitive area, which suggests that either the defense has a duty to put on some information, I'm going to be expecting that from them, or that he has a bias in which he's trying to coach the defense on how to run their case. You start to look at the whole tenor of this, and it appears that you really might have somebody who's not of judicial temperament. How do you respond to that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the interesting thing is when you first read that question from him or that explanation of him, maybe the defense should ask this, it does appear that he is coaxing the defense, or I think as senior trial counsel called it, a third defense counsel in the jury box. However, during his individual voir dire in the Article 39A session, immediately after that, he explicitly explains that he was not trying to help either side, and he was simply wondering where that information came from. He states on page 419 of the record, he was stating, the defense was, it wasn't necessarily in favor of either side, it was just a question for my own edification. Because he kept stating, you went to Mountain Home Police Department and you told this lie. Did you not say that? And the question was, where was the fact of that? Where was he getting that information from? That's pretty much the basis of my question. The military judge then expressly asks him, were you attempting to help either the government or defense? Negative. Do you see the defense has some burden to present evidence? Negative. Do you believe you are a fair and impartial court member? Yes. Will you agree to follow my instructions? Yes, ma'am. And so when you look at that, those things, That explanation helps you understand what he was getting at in that question.
And his question, in his statement to the effect, it's something the defense should ask?
Your Honor, when you...
How is that not suggesting some proactivity on his part that's way out of line?
Your Honor, it's his inexperience knowing how the court-martial process works. He's never been on a court panel. He's a young captain. He's never seen these proceedings outside of law and order. He even says that himself in the initial voir dire. He says, I don't know, Burden, whatever you guys are talking about. I've seen law and order. That's my extent of my knowledge. So understanding, and the military judge even recognizes that. She says, I was concerned about him burden shifting or helping either side initially. But after I talked to him, that's not in line with his explanation. Now, when you look back at his initial voir dire, his initial voir dire is a little, you're right, rambling. He kind of starts talking about a whole bunch of different things. But when you break it down and look ultimately at what he's saying, he's simply discussing the burden of proof as he understands it, and a correct burden of proof. He's saying, I want to make sure that we have sufficient evidence before we convict somebody. I want to make sure that there's not just a mere accusation, that there has to be some evidence there before we decide that somebody is guilty of a crime. And here we have him asking questions and seeking additional evidence, making sure he's getting to the bottom of what occurred. Frankly, when you compare these two, when you have this member, this is somebody that we want on a panel. This is somebody who is seeking evidence, looking at both sides and making sure he fully understands what is happening in this case before he makes a decision. And I would point, yes, Your Honor.
I do want to break down the abuse of discretion a little bit. Is it the appellant's position that the judge applied the incorrect legal test, or that their application of that test was an abuse?
Your Honor, frankly, it's very hard to decide. When looking at her ruling, it is very unclear as to what she is doing. There is a lot of pulling facts down in.
Is there some point which the appellant believes that the military judge articulated a test that was incorrect?
No, Your Honor, the appellant does not believe she articulated any test. She simply said implied bias. There was no analysis or test otherwise put in there. And I just want to jump back, Your Honors, very quickly to Captain J.G.'s initial voir dire and that kind of how that pulls in and pulls together. The totality of the circumstances here, the military judge is obligated to look at all of those, obviously. However, what you have is a member whom everybody thought after initial voir dire was good to go. There was no challenge for cause whatsoever against this member. And then it wasn't until this question arose and this further explanation that all of a sudden there was a problem.
But isn't it Peters that talks about, in the context of actual bias, how a member's willingness to follow instructions is an important part of the rehabilitation process in the initial voir dire?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And he explains that as well during his second individual voir dire, where he says, I'm sorry, I know you said, but I was just confused. He said, I know you gave us some instructions on how to ask witness questions, but I was just confused. And the military judge even makes a finding about that as well.
But there's no requirement that his alleged failure to follow instructions was intentional or inadvertent or just an inability to do so. If he says that he can't, or if he demonstrates that he isn't following instructions, doesn't that call into question all those assumptions we make about rehabilitation after initial voir dire?
Potentially, Your Honor, but I would point the court to the record at 428, where the military judge says, I'm going to make sure I'm going to get I'm sorry, 427, where the military judge said there's some argument that he did violate my instruction. I think the stronger argument, though, is that I didn't give them an instruction on requesting evidence, and that's what he was doing. That's what she says at 427, and it's clear that everybody came to the conclusion that he was just requesting evidence. She had given them initial instructions on member questions and things like that 2 days prior, but her information or instructions on requesting evidence wouldn't come to the conclusion of the trial. And she points that out and states that to all the counsel, and she even recognizes it herself and makes that finding a fact.
Captain Scherer, on page 8 of your brief, you basically state the grant of a challenge on an implied bias standard for the government must be closely scrutinized. And I was just curious, are you asking this court to apply a new, more stringent standard, or are you asking us to apply what exists currently in terms of the statute, the regulations, the rules, and the case law?
Yes, Your Honor. Nothing more stringent than what applies currently. And I'd point the court to United States v. Nash. Castillo-Peters and James all discuss how the, along with Clay, all discuss how the implied bias standard, when applied to the government, should only be used extremely rarely. And that was what I was talking about earlier. It's not a new standard. It's what exists in the case law currently, where when you remove the liberal grant mandate, because that is, the government is not entitled to that, then you have this very rare circumstances where we would apply implied bias to the government. In fact, I think it's explained best in Clay, where actual bias is found, a finding of implied bias would not be unusual. But where there's no finding of actual bias, implied bias must be independently established. And our argument is that it wasn't independently established in this particular case. Barring any further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Government counsel, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Allred, judges, may it please the court, I am Major Jeremy Gaiman, and along with Mr. Bruce, we represent the United States in this case. The military judge in this case did not abuse her discretion when she excused a member for a government implied bias challenge. I first want to start off by talking a little bit about the standard of review. The standard of review in this case is less deferential than abuse of discretion, but more deferential than de novo, and that comes recently restated by Caff and Peters and in Woods. And in Woods, CAF reiterated that and reaffirmed the standard review for an implied bias, stating that implied bias is an objective test. But implied bias is an objective test, and it looks at credibility along with facts. So it's not pure credibility like an actual bias test, which relies solely on credibility. CAF stated in Woods they declined to amend the standard of review in an implied bias setting, because they believe it affords a level of deference to a military judge in light of the fact that resolving claims of implied bias involves questions of fact and demeanor, not just law, which is why you have, it's less deferential than abuse of discretion, but more deferential than de novo review. And in this case, the military judge gets deference, and this is why, because a military judge will not get deference, as the appellate stated, if they don't cite to the correct law and they don't put their reasoning on the record or have a factual basis. In Peters, CAF stated where a military judge places on the record his analysis and application of the law to the facts, deference is surely warranted. And in this case, the military judge applied the correct law as well as putting her reasoning on the record. The standard review is also important in this case because CAF recognizes, as does this court, that discussing voir dire challenges is difficult on appellate review. In Dale, and Judge Crawford's dissenting opinion stated that it's just sometimes second-guessing the judge. In Townsend and Judge Baker's concurring opinion, he wrote that appellate review of member challenges is ungainly, if not impractical, tool to uphold and reinforce the importance of RCM 912 in military justice practice. Among other things, appellate courts do not have the benefit of hearing the tone of a response or the observe the demeanor of voir dire responses. Further, where matters of appearance and nuance rather than clear error are involved, courts might well be hesitant to reset the clock. And in Dockery, this court stated in citing to the Supreme Court that rulings on challenges for cause are made on the spot and under pressure. The resolution of jury bias questions is never clear-cut. And that's why judges are entitled to deference in these situations. And the implied bias, moving on to the test for implied bias, and that is the perception or appearance of fairness in the military justice system. And as appellate conceded, the government is entitled to make implied bias challenges at the trial level. This is an objective standard, and it's viewed through the eyes of the public. And the test is not that there has to be or there must be, but the test is that there could be or maybe or possibly. If you look at the language used in a lot of decisions like Peters, Moreno, Doherty, and Woods, they use language like that. In Peters, the CAF stated that there could undermine the perception.
Is there a way to separate that from the liberal grant mandate?
The expansive language that there could be? Absolutely. The court, in a lot of the cases, they talk about how it's a close case. In this case, it was a close case. And because of the liberal grant mandate, the judge should have erred on the side of caution. It's kind of the language they used. And the idea is that if there's ever a close case, if there's ever the judge is on the edge of whether they should or should not grant the challenge, with the liberal grant mandate, if it's coming from the defense, from the appellant, then they should grant that. They must grant that. That's the idea behind the liberal grant mandate. If it's a close case, they should grant it. But that doesn't mean that if a government makes a challenge and the judge is uncertain or the judge is concerned, it doesn't mean they can't grant the challenge. It just means that when defense is making the challenge under the liberal grant mandate, that they have to, they need to, err side of the caution. That's kind of the language the courts use, is that in a close case, this was a close case and the military judge should have granted the defense challenge for cause, or the judge should have erred on the side of caution and granted the challenge. But again, in Peters, Moreno, and Doherty, the language, you don't have to find that there absolutely is a perception, but that there could be a perception. Moreno used the language, the objective observer could reasonably question. They could harbor a reasonable concern. In Doherty, this court used the language, the public could find the unsolicited response raised an issue. And in Woods, CAF stated that a reasonable observer may disagree that the member was rehabilitated by the statements they made. So again, we're not looking for, does this absolutely show prejudice? Does this absolutely appear to the public? No, the test is more, what we're looking at more is, could it possibly be? Does what they say, how they act, how they comport themselves during voir dire or during the course of the trial, does that raise, could that raise, might that raise a perception of unfairness in the military justice system? And again, this is an objective test. So the credibility, the rehabilitation of the member is not paramount. So even if the military judge believes the member, even if they find that perhaps what they're stating, they were uncertain about what they should ask, or the member was rehabilitated, they didn't understand the judge's instructions, or they didn't understand the law, even if that's the case, even if the military judge believes them and the member is rehabilitated, that is not the paramount decision. This is not actual bias. Credibility is not the only thing. This is also the objective test of the public perception. You look at Dalton, CAF stated, while the military judge's assessment of an excused court member's credibility is useful and warrants great deference on the issue of actual bias, it is not dispositive on the issue of implied bias. In Woods, CAF stated, while it is often possible to rehabilitate a member on a possible question of actual bias, questions regarding the appearance of fairness may nonetheless remain. And if you look at cases like Doherty, Peters, and Woods, you'll see that those members were rehabilitated, that they stated that, you know, they could follow the judge's instructions or they were mistaken or perhaps they had a reason for the specific language that they used, but that didn't matter. Their credibility didn't matter, whether they could follow the judge's instructions or not or had a reason for why they asked a question. It was the appearance that caused the problem. It was the fact that perhaps members, perhaps the public might believe that they weren't rehabilitated. Like in Woods. And Woods dealt with a member who was just mistaken about the law. She believed that the law was guilty until proven innocent. And the judge rehabilitated her, and she corrected herself. And she was uncertain about the law, just didn't know it, said she could follow the instructions, but that was enough for the court to say, no, the public might perceive that she wasn't rehabilitated, and that was enough to be an implied bias concern. So there's two questions when looking at the judge's decision in implied biases. Did the military judge apply the correct law? And then did she have a factual basis? Did she put that reasoning on the record? And the military judge in this case absolutely applied the correct law. You look at some of the language that she used throughout this discussion, and it's important to kind of look. They had a lengthy discussion. The judge wanted information from counsel, discussed her thought process with counsel and her concerns about this member over several pages in the record of trial. And she stated that she wanted to look something up. The court took a recess. She came back. She said, I wanted to know if there was something more than impartiality that we were looking at here. She stated, implied bias. In theory, he can follow my instructions. He would like to follow my instructions. He regret that he didn't follow my instructions, but in fact, he didn't follow my instructions. And he asked the witness a question, questions that weren't for the witness. Instead, they were for, I don't know who they were for. She specifically stated on the record that this is not actual bias, no actual bias. And then she stated the test for implied bias. She stated she was concerned that of the perception that somebody looking in, and that is the test of implied bias. We're concerned with the perception of fairness in the military justice system. And then she stated that she did not feel comfortable leaving him as a member because of implied bias. And also, you can look at how she dealt with other member excusals to see if she followed the law, or the military judge knew the law. This court's decision in Anderson stated that the military judge knew the distinction between the actual implied bias, and this makes us more confident that the military judge properly analyzed the challenge. So you can look at her other decisions that were made in the course of this trial to see if the military judge knew and understood the law and applied the law correctly. And if you looked at the number of other challenges that she made, she granted several government challenges for cause, implied bias, and she did not apply the liberal grant mandate to any of those. And she denied several defense challenges for implied bias, and she applied the correct law of perception, and she applied and discussed the liberal grant mandate. So in this case, the military judge had a firm grasp of the law, a firm grasp of what tests were appropriate and whether or not she should apply or not apply the liberal grant mandate. And that's important because the liberal grant mandate does not apply to the government, and the judge in this case did not apply the liberal grant mandate to this excusal of implied bias made by the government. So this court could be confident that she applied the correct law. Factual basis is the next question, and was it articulated on the record by the military judge? And it was. She stated numerous times that she was concerned with burden shift, and she was concerned that the member was not following her instructions. She stated, with regard to following her instructions, except he failed. I mean, he did. He just failed. And she was concerned with the question for the defense. What does that mean? And she stated again, so he didn't exactly follow my advisement. And there's some argument he didn't follow that instruction about how to question witnesses. And senior trial counsel in the case discussed several of his concerns about the member, and the military judge stated, initially I saw those, discussing the apology the member made, not knowing what he was thinking, as well as the fact that when he asked his question, where he said that this question is for the defense to ask, he used defense instead of stating the parties or someone or the military judge or somebody else. He specifically referenced the defense, and she noted that she saw those as well. And then she goes back and she states she wants to review her notes from voir dire. And that's important because regarding implied bias, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. And indeed, in this court's decision in Anderson, this court noted that the military judge in that case went back and actually reviewed her notes. It was dealing with a member later on in the trial. And in Anderson, the military judge went back and reviewed her notes from voir dire as well. So the military judge in this case did the exact same thing. She knew the totality of the circumstances were important. She goes back to review her notes from voir dire. And they raised concerns for her when she did that. There were concerns because the member was asked about zero tolerance, and the member stated, leadership not going to be tolerant with it. There were concerns when the member stated in voir dire that, does somebody expect action in sexual assault cases? And the member said, not expectation, but a burden of proof before an allegation is made. And goes on to state, this is the member, Captain J.G., stating this, kind of the same, well, yeah, I mean the burden of proof before any accusation. Otherwise, he said, she said, other crap. Who's telling the truth? No one wants to deal with this stuff. And these were things the military judge had flagged in her notes from voir dire, and then looking upon what was happening during trial was concerning her. And she kind of puts all this together, and she even states that. She says, looking at everything together, totality of the circumstances, he said, she said, other crap, no one wants to deal with that stuff, statement arguably burden shift, didn't know what he was thinking, which may be an inability to follow instructions, didn't really follow what I said to keep in mind with the questioning of witnesses. She articulates what her concerns were. In fact, on the record, it's very clear on the record on page 430. Military judge highlights really, honestly, her main concern here is when she states that, is there an expectation of a certain action with a sexual assault allegation? This is the question to the member. And the member stated, and this is the military judge reading off her notes, and the answer was, not expectation, but burden of proof before accusation is made. And this part I highlighted, that's the military judge speaking. The member said, kind of the same, well, yeah, I mean, a burden of proof before any accusation. Otherwise, he said, she said, other crap. Who's telling the truth? No one wants to deal with that stuff. And then the military judge says this, and now he asked defense to introduce evidence of other things the alleged victim said, or at least wants somebody to give it to him. Depending on if you go with what he stated in front of the group or stated individually. That was the military judge's concern, that this member had something in his head that he was following and not her instructions. And she said that explicitly whenever she made her ruling, that I don't think there is actual bias. I am concerned that of the perception that somebody looking in can think that he's got ideas in his head and those are what he's following and not necessarily what I'm saying. So I don't feel comfortable leaving him as a member of the court because of implied bias.
Is it the government's position that his failure to follow instructions alone would constitute a sufficient implied bias to justify the challenge? Or is it the failure to follow instructions combined with these other manifestations that he perhaps thought that one side or another had a burden?
Your Honor, it's the totality of the circumstances. It's everything the judge looked at.
So that would give this court good reason to find whether or not he followed instructions. But if it was just that, if it was just a failure to follow instructions, willful, inadvertent, whatever, would that be enough to substantiate the excusal?
Yes, Your Honor, it could, because we're looking at implied bias, which may the public have a perception. And absolutely, if the judge in these circumstances, which is why we give the judge's deference, if the member's demeanor when he said that, if the action in the courtroom, if his words in the courtroom came across like he was ignoring the judge, he wasn't paying attention to the answers, he was demanding his own evidence, he had the things in his head with the he said, she said crap, because that exchange was the defense had challenged her about something she had previously said. So it's a he said, she said scenario between defense counsel saying, well, you previously said this, and the member of the witness on the stand saying, this is what I said or this is what I remember saying. And now you have the member who's been instructed by the judge saying, this is a question for the defense to act. Is that a fact? Because we know that when he told the military judge in voir dire that, listen, what this is, he said crap, I don't want to deal with that. Who's telling the truth? Nobody wants to deal with that. So absolutely, in that context, that would be enough because the members, the public could perceive that he does have something in his mind other than what the judge has instructed. And that very well could be enough. If you look at the language, too, used by members in cases like Woods, Nash, and Dockery, you have language from members that in and of itself is either confused or maybe is subject to different interpretations and has different meanings behind it. Like in Woods, the statement really from the member was that they were guilty until proven innocent. And she was just clearly mistaken about the law. In Nash, the question during trial posed to the accused wife in that case, who was a witness, was, do you think a pedophile can be rehabilitated? And in Nash, the member went on to explain that he had this reasoning for why he asked the question. He was testing the naiveness of that witness because it was the accused wife. He wanted to know about bias. So there was an explanation for the question. There was confusion behind the statement in Woods. And in Dockery, the statement was, but for some reason an African-American person already got dismissed. So you have statements that perhaps have different explanations behind them, that have a reason for their being asked. Either they were trying to get at a specific point and there's a logical reason for that, or they were just confused about the law, or they were just stating something that they were uncertain about, or stating something we don't really know what meaning it has behind it, like in Dockery. For some reason, an African-American person already got dismissed. But that's the problem with implied biases. Okay, so maybe you were mistaken. We believe you that you were mistaken about the law. And okay, maybe you were really trying to get at bias in that when you asked that question. But in implied bias situation, we look at, could the public still perceive something is unfair by them asking that question? Even if we believe them, could there still be a perception? And that's important in this case, because perhaps you could disagree with the military judge's interpretation on what those statements mean, but that would be a de novo review. We're not substituting our judgment for the military judges. We give them discretion. And even if there is multiple interpretations for the words used by a member, if the military judge finds that, well, perhaps there could be, there might be, the public might perceive unfairness in the system just by what they say, even though they claim that they're not biased, they claim they can follow my instructions, that doesn't matter. And in this case, the military judge had concern and did not feel comfortable leaving him as a member because of his statements. Whether he explained them away or not, she still had concerns about the perception. And you do test for president. You do test for prejudice. Even if you find the military judge did abuse her discretion, you test for prejudice. This is not structural error. In Dockery, this court stated that it was not structural error, and that was a grant of a government challenge specifically. This court went through a prejudice analysis in that case. This was also stated by CAF in Brooks. In Newsom, they dealt with a voir dire issue, and CAF applied a prejudice analysis, as well as in Gooch, a prejudice analysis was conducted as well. And there is always a strong presumption that the error is not structural. And that was cited in James and Record, both citing to Brooks' case, which is 66 MJ 221. So, Your Honor, the military judge did not err, did not abuse her discretion when she granted the government challenge for implied bias. Thank you. I see my time is up. Any questions, Your Honor?
None for me in the interview.
Thank you, Major Gaiman. Captain Scherr?
Your Honors, Captain J.G. was looking for underlying impeachment evidence. That is something that likely happens in every court martial where there is any question of credibility. Now, the government argues that the military judge gets deference here because she applied the correct law and placed her reasons on the record. When you look specifically to her words, she puts the incantation of implied bias on the record. But that's it. There's no further analysis, there's no further explanation, and nothing to dispute the pages just prior to this conclusion, that she finds there was nothing wrong with what he said, he was simply seeking evidence, he was not trying to help either side, and he was not burden shifting. CAF said that in Peters just last term. The mere incantation of an implied bias is given less deference. Now, the government discusses demeanor, and they said there could still be a perception of an issue here, of an implied bias. The problem is there's no discussion of demeanor on the record whatsoever. The military judge does not discuss that in any way, shape, or form. So all we have are the words used by the member. That's it, 100%. And the member says he is not biased, he is not trying to help either side. Now, this could be a perception idea. That may be true if the military judge had not rehabilitated this member absolutely. And the member's explanation did not explain what he was seeking. Yes, he was inartful in his initial questions. But his individual voir dire gave an adequate explanation of what he was seeking, what he was looking for, and there was nothing wrong with that. And frankly, after the military judge's rehabilitation of the member, the government doesn't do anything. They just simply go with it. And that takes us also to looking at the initial individual voir dire. As I said in my first argument, yes, the military judge should be able to look at that. But the government cannot now stand up here after they rehabilitated this member in initial voir dire. They rehabilitated him and did not challenge him. And so there is no way that they can stand up here now and say he was biased towards the government from the very beginning, because they did not believe that in initial voir dire. They sought to keep him.
So you reject any idea that there could be cumulative effects?
No, Your Honor, I believe there could be cumulative effects. And as I said, I think the military judge needs to look at the totality of the circumstances. I don't think the government has the opportunity to come here now and say, well, his initial voir dire was really bad, too. Now, I'd point the court. Woods, Nash, and Dockery are interesting cases, and I'd like to talk just briefly about those. In Woods, the member, although she said, yes, I misunderstood the law, she specifically said that she believed we should operate under a guilty until proven innocent standard. So even though she said, yes, I can follow the military judge's instructions, she said, but I really think that we should be guilty until proven innocent. In Nash, the member, the court specifically points out, because this, again, is right before deliberations in the middle of trial. This is not in Woods, where it was ahead of trial. The court says it is important to keep in consideration, as in this case, the issue can arise at any time during trial. Therefore, it is incumbent upon the military judge to tailor the application of the implied bias test to the context presented. And in those particular cases, those were extreme. Those were extreme cases. And that is not what you have in this case. In this case, the member gives an adequate instruction, or gives an adequate explanation, one that does not leave any lingering doubt. The military judge fully rehabilitates him and concludes as much. She makes findings of fact and concludes, yes, he was set. He was good to go. Now, the government concedes there is no actual bias, and that's what the military judge said. And that is the key point here. All of the case law is replete that implied bias standard without the liberal grant mandate should be exceedingly rare, should be an extreme circumstance, extreme. That's what you have in Clay and Curtis, where members are saying, no, there's no way I could vote for, no way I could vote for the death penalty. Or in Woods, I believe we should still probably operate under a guilty until proven innocent standard. Or in Nash, well, I'm just trying to test her naivete because, you know, we want to know, does she know about pedophiles? Does she understand about pedophiles? Those are the conclusions that these members are making. And those are the extreme cases. That is not what we have here. The military judge concluded he was not biased. He was not burden shifting. He was simply seeking underlying impeachment evidence, which members look for all the time. And the government simply cannot have it both ways. This member cannot be biased against the government and against the defense. If they are, they're the perfect member, and they should remain on the panel. Barring any further questions, thank you for your time.
Counsel, thank you for your arguments. We will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.